Welcome to the debate. Imagine this. You are a physician in a pediatric emergency department.
Okay. High stress environment.
Yeah, exactly. And a 7-year-old child comes in, struggling to breathe. It's a severe asthma attack.
Terrifying for the parents, obviously.
Oh, absolutely terrifying. But you execute a flawless medical intervention. You provide oxygen, administer beta agonists and systemic corticosteroids. You perfectly review the inhaler spacer technique with the parents and draft this, you know, meticulous written action plan.
The gold standard of care.
Right. You save that child's life. And then a few hours later, you discharge them. You send them right back to the damp, mold-infested apartment that triggered the attack in the first place. You know they will be back.
Right. It's a revolving door.
I mean, it is a devastating scenario. And it cuts right to the heart of what we expect from our physicians, right? Because on one hand, the clinical rescue was perfect. The child is breathing.
Yes, they are.
But on the other hand, we all know you cannot medicate away a collapsed ceiling.
Exactly. And that profound tension brings us to the core of our discussion today. We are looking at the evolution of medical competency following the release of CanMeds 2026.
A massive shift for the field.
It really is. For those who might just know CanMeds as a background acronym, it is the foundational framework that dictates medical education and practice standards in Canada, and frankly, influences them globally.
Yeah, it sets the tone for everything.
Right. And we are examining this through the lens of a phenomenal August 2026 conceptual manuscript by Dr. Bishara Sahali, which is titled, Competence is Necessary but Not Sufficient.
It really is a provocative piece of writing. I mean, it forces us to ask some very uncomfortable questions about where the boundaries of the medical profession actually lie.
And that is the central question we are debating today. Should medical competency frameworks formally incorporate structural enabling conditions and distributed accountability across non-medical domains? Or does expanding the framework in this way dangerously dilute clinical focus and overburden an already fragile healthcare system?
A very real concern, honestly.
Well, I take the position that professional competence is functionally meaningless if we don't formally integrate the material and institutional conditions that actually sustain health. I support Dr. Sahali's life-grounded framework, the LIFE framework, because it finally operationalizes this reality, giving us a mechanism to address that moldy apartment.
And I take the opposing view. While the social determinants of health, like poor housing or food insecurity, are undeniably real and deeply impactful, formalizing them into a required medical competency framework is a dangerous overreach.
Overreach?
Yes, overreach. Expanding a doctor's mandate into structural determinants risks unmanageable complexity. It blurs jurisdictional boundaries, and ultimately, it distracts from what patients need most from us when they are sick, which is core clinical expertise.
Well, let's lay out our positions clearly. I look at the current state of medical education and practice, and I see what the manuscript brilliantly identifies as the competency sufficiency error.
The magical thinking, right?
Exactly. This false, almost magical belief that clinical capability alone can produce health. We train doctors to be perfect biological mechanics, but biological mechanics alone cannot overcome a toxic environment.
I mean, I agree that biology isn't the whole picture, but calling clinical capability magical belief feels slightly dismissive of the profound power of modern medicine, doesn't it?
I don't mean to dismiss clinical power at all. The clinical power is the baseline. It's essential. But let's look at the asthma tracer from the text again. The harm recurs because the environment is hostile.
Right.
What Dr. Sahali proposes is the LIFE operational grammar. That stands for life, influences, fit, and evidence. What this framework does is legally and administratively link clinical care to distributed accountability.
Okay, but how does that actually look?
It forces public and institutional actors, like housing authorities or school boards, to own their specific parts of health creation. It stops treating the clinician as an isolated hero fighting an unwinnable battle against the environment and starts treating them as a node in a connected system.
I come at it from a completely different way. We are in total agreement that the mold in the apartment and the lack of a clean air plan at the school are driving the asthma. But the stress test here is what the text calls complexity versus usability.
Which is a valid metric, sure.
Right. And when you formalize housing and public infrastructure into a medical competency framework, you risk what the author rightly warns against, unfunded moral delegation.
Which is a crucial concept, I agree.
It really is. Unfunded moral delegation is just an academic way of saying we are dumping society's macro-level failures onto the shoulders of exhausted medical residents and giving them zero budget or authority to fix them.
But that's not what the framework...
Let me finish. A physician's primary duty is clinical rescue. When a child cannot breathe, they need albuterol, not a seminar on municipal housing policy. Asking a clinical service to audit whether a landlord has fixed a leak fundamentally conflates medical expertise with public policy enforcement. You are medicalizing social issues in a way that risks paralyzing the clinic without ever actually fixing the building.
See, I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning because it just misinterprets how the mechanism of distributed accountability actually functions. You're suggesting that the LIFE framework turns the physician into a housing inspector.
It essentially does.
No, the text explicitly does the opposite.
How so? It requires the physician to act on the structural deficiency.
It requires them to route it, not fix it. This is where the FIT component of the LIFE framework comes in. FIT maps out the CanMed's roles, specifically protecting the medical expert role.
Okay.
It strictly bounds the physician's job to diagnosing the asthma, prescribing the inhaler, and identifying the clinically relevant exposure, in this case, the mold. The framework doesn't ask the doctor to grab a toolbox.
Obviously not literally, but...
It simply demands that the hospital system build a coordinated handoff to a named owner.
A handoff to whom, exactly? Because in the real world, these magic named owners don't always exist.
To the entity with the actual jurisdiction, a medical legal partner integrated into the hospital who handles tenant rights, or a direct public health liaison to the school board responsible for the clean air plans.
If they have one.
The framework is asking the healthcare institution, the hospital administration, the faculty of medicine, to build the digital and administrative pathways so the clinician isn't acting alone. It's about the doctor officially and legally passing the baton to the person whose actual job it is to fix the pipes.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. Implementing this without existing, fully funded institutional pathways is like giving a pilot an incredibly detailed dashboard showing that the plane's engines are failing, but not connecting those controls to the actual engine.
That's quite the analogy.
It just creates high-definition anxiety. The manuscript itself explicitly warns us about institutional capability.
It does, yes. It acknowledges that institutions need to step up.
But let's walk through a day in the life of a resident under this new competency framework. Imagine a third-year pediatrics resident. They've just spent 45 minutes with a family. They log into the electronic health record to do this life constraints audit. What happens in the real world?
Well, they document the constraints.
And then what? The clinic doesn't have an electronic referral mechanism for legal aid. The hospital social worker position has been vacant for 6 months. The municipal housing authority has a 3-year wait list.
Which is exactly the reality of our current system. That's the problem.
Right. But in that very normal scenario, the LIFE audit just creates a red-rated administrative burden. You end up with a resident forced to click through menus, checking boxes to document that the structural conditions are failing, and escalating this failure to an institutional leader who has absolutely no budget to fix it.
But
it ties a trainee's academic and professional assessment to an institutional void. You are turning highly trained clinicians into data clerks for civic failures.
But making that void visible is exactly the point of the framework. If the referral pathway doesn't exist, the resident is not penalized for failing to fix the housing.
They're just penalized with paperwork.
No, under the old system, that resident might be given a poor evaluation for failing their CanMed's health advocate role because they didn't magically solve the patient's poverty. The LIFE audit protects the trainee.
By giving them more checkboxes?
It shifts the failure from an individual doctor's lack of advocacy to a systemic deficit. It creates hard data that the institution is making promises it cannot keep.
Making systemic deficits visible is a wonderful goal for a sociology paper or a public health audit.
but in a medical competency framework, the literal rubric we use to decide if a resident is allowed to practice medicine independently, making it visible translates to thousands of hours of unpaid, unresolvable administrative tracking.
I think you're overstating the burden.
I don't think I am. And that leads us to a much harder stress test than childhood asthma. It's one thing to coordinate with a local landlord for one asthmatic kid, but what happens when the toxic environment isn't a single apartment building?
Ah, you're talking about the cardiometabolic disease and food systems tracer from Dr. Saheli's paper.
Exactly. What happens when the cause of the disease is the entire global food supply chain? How does a doctor pass the baton to a 16-gigaton agricultural industry?
I actually think this is where the framework proves its sophistication, because it forces us to look at the absurdity of our current approach. Let's look at the data from the text. Dr. Saheli cites the SELECT trial.
Right, the semaglutide study.
Yes, a massive landmark study, a perfect example of modern clinical rescue. They took adults with established cardiovascular disease who were overweight or obese, and they gave them semaglutide.
A highly effective GLP-1 receptor agonist.
Right. And over 40 months, major cardiovascular events dropped from 8.0% to 6.5%. That is a massive triumph of the medical expert role.
Unquestionably.
A life-grounded approach absolutely does not abandon that medical intervention for vague policy goals. It prescribes the semaglutide, but treating that successful medication as a reason to ignore the social production of the disease is a profound failure of logic.
How is it a failure if the patient's cardiovascular risk is objectively reduced? The drug did exactly what it was supposed to do.
Because the influences driving the massive incidence of the disease across the population remain completely unchecked. I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective.
Go ahead.
The paradox of modern medicine is that we have engineered a miracle drug like semaglutide to save a patient from a food environment that we have allowed to become entirely toxic. We are bailing out the boat with a gold-plated bucket while ignoring the gaping hole in the hull.
The hole in the hull being the food environment?
Exactly. If we celebrate a 1.5% absolute risk reduction from an incredibly expensive pharmaceutical while completely ignoring the food unaffordability, the predatory commercial marketing, and the wage stagnation that are driving the metabolic crisis in the first place, we aren't creating health. We are just managing the decline of public health at a very high profit margin.
Okay, that's a strong claim.
The LIFE framework says, yes, you must prescribe the indicated therapy, but you must also structurally address the food environment. You can't just tell a shift worker to eat better when they live in a food swamp and work two jobs.
Well, I agree that telling a shift worker to just eat better is empty advice. But again, look at how far you're stretching the boundary of medical responsibility.
I don't think it's a stretch.
The manuscript explicitly brings up planetary health and global food systems. It cites Food and Agriculture Organization data showing that global agri-food systems emit 16.5 gigatons of greenhouse gases.
Yes, a staggering number.
That is 32% of all global anthropogenic emissions. Are we seriously suggesting that a local physician or even a regional hospital network should be held accountable for international agricultural supply chains or commercial determinants of health?
Not accountable for managing the global supply chain. That would be ridiculous. But accountable for aligning their own institutional power to not make the problem worse and contributing clinical evidence to the bodies that do regulate it. Think about hospital food procurement. Why should a hospital serve ultra-processed food to cardiac patients?
I mean, hospital procurement is one thing, but the mechanism of action of a physician is completely mismatched to the scale of this problem. Take the Hall et al. Inpatient crossover trial referenced in the text.
Oh, the metabolic ward study on ultra-processed foods?
Yes. It was a tightly controlled experiment. They had 20 adults in a clinical setting, and they found that people consumed about 500 more kilocalories a day when given an ultra-processed diet compared to an unprocessed diet.
Significant findings.
The dietary impact is undeniably real. The ultra-processed food environment directly causes weight gain. But a physician's scope cannot realistically manage the global commercial food environment. If you tie a doctor's sense of professional competence to their ability to alter commercial determinants of health, you are diluting their clinical mandate. You are asking a doctor to fight a 16-gigaton global industry from an 8-by-10-foot examination room.
That's an interesting point, though I would frame it differently.
How so?
The LIFE framework does not ask the physician to fight the 16 gigaton industry from the exam room. It asks the physician to formally recognize that the patient is fighting that industry. It asks the medical profession to stop shaming the patient for non-compliance when they fail to lose weight.
I agree with stopping the shaming, certainly.
And it asks the medical institution to link the clinical data they gather to public health governance. And it does this with incredible nuance. It doesn't just dictate sweeping global rules. For example, it strictly rejects the idea of a universal planetary diet.
Which, to be fair, is a very important safeguard in Dr. Sahale's text.
Exactly. If you took a narrow, carbon-only approach, a global health body might look at emissions and dictate a standardized, plant-based diet for everyone on Earth. But the framework explicitly highlights distinctions-based practice.
Right, recognizing different contexts.
It points out that imposing a universal plant-based diet would utterly devastate food security in Inuit Nunganat. It would ignore traditional harvesting rights and the cultural necessity of country food, because you can't just replace traditional hunting with imported greenhouse vegetables in the Arctic. Right. The framework recognizes that environmental optimization cannot override equity and indigenous sovereignty. It dictates strict adherence to First Nations OCAP principles.
For our listeners who might not be familiar with OCAP, we should probably break that down quickly.
Of course, OCAP stands for Ownership, Control, Access, and Possession. Historically, medical researchers would go into indigenous communities, extract health data, publish their papers, and leave, offering absolutely no structural benefit to the community.
A terrible legacy.
Truly. OCAP principles mean that the community itself actually owns and controls their health data. By embedding OCAP into the competency framework, it proves that the LIFE model isn't about doctors hoarding authority and trying to play savior to fix the world. It is precisely about doctors distributing authority back to the legitimate rights holders.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered how that actually plays out in the final metric of the LIFE acronym?
The evidence component?
Right. We've talked about LIFE, influences, and fit. Let's talk about evidence. You mentioned OCAP and distributing authority to the community. Let's look at the Kahnawake School's Diabetes Prevention Project, which is discussed at length in the text.
It is a landmark example of community-based governance.
Absolutely. It is exemplary community governance. It was deeply respectful of local knowledge, heavily reliant on shared ownership, and it operated with tremendous integrity. It was basically everything the LIFE framework hopes for.
Yes.
But what were the actual clinical outcomes? The text notes that over an 8-year period, the results were decidedly mixed. Early improvements in physical activity and diet among the children were not uniformly maintained, and the broader obesity-related trends in the community remained incredibly challenging.
Which really speaks to the sheer gravity of the commercial food environment pushing back against them.
Precisely. Why did it struggle to maintain results? Because even with the best, most ethically governed community intervention in the world, broader environmental and commercial pressures overrode the local effort.
Sure, but...
So here is my issue. I am not saying we abandoned community governance. I am saying that tying medical competency, a physician's professional evaluation, to these structural and political conditions guarantees failure in the evidence metric of your own framework.
Well, I don't see it as guaranteeing failure. I see it as redefining what success looks like in a complex system.
But if a fully funded, beautifully governed 8-year community project cannot reliably move the needle on childhood obesity because the macroeconomic forces are simply too large, how on earth can we assess medical learners or clinical services on these exact same metrics?
We assess their systemic engagement.
You are evaluating healthcare institutions on outcomes that are fundamentally beyond their control. This is the very definition of paralysis by analysis. If we go down this road, we will spend all our time, budget, and academic energy auditing our failure to change the world rather than efficiently delivering the semaglutide and the asthma inhalers that actually keep people alive today.
I hear your concern about administrative paralysis. It is a genuine fear for overworked clinicians. I won't deny that. But I think you're misapplying how the evidence metric would function in practice.
How so?
The evidence isn't just, did we cure societal obesity? That would be absurd. The evidence could be, did we successfully reduce emergency room bounce backs for this specific child
by establishing a working digital referral to a housing authority?
Okay.
Or did we ensure this First Nations community retained absolute control over their own cardiometabolic health data during our intervention?
So the evidence is about the process of collaboration, not just the biological outcome.
Yes, exactly. The LIFE framework is a necessary, life-grounded evolution of our profession. It refuses to play along with the polite fiction that excellent clinical treatment alone can overcome a toxic environment. And ironically, by properly mapping the CanMed's roles to legitimate systemic contributions, it actually protects clinicians from the very burnout you were worried about.
By giving them boundaries.
Yes, it gives them a boundary. It says, do your clinical job excellently, and then hand off the structural job explicitly. It demands real institutional accountability rather than relying on the silent, uncompensated suffering of frontline workers who currently just watch their patients go right back into harm's way.
And, you know, while I deeply respect the intellectual rigor of Dr. Sally's framework and I agree that the current system causes immense moral injury to doctors, I maintain that formalizing this into medical competency risks untethering medicine from its core purpose.
Even with the explicit boundaries?
Yes, because the primary non-negotiable mission of a physician is clinical rescue and proportionate treatment. Patients need to know that when they are sick, their doctor is focused entirely on their biology, their immediate safety, and their timely treatment. If we entangle medical education in unresolvable socioeconomic, jurisdictional, and ecological conflicts, we risk losing the profound, specialized focus that makes medical expertise so uniquely valuable to society in the first place. We simply cannot let the pursuit of perfect systemic conditions delay or devalue the provision of necessary clinical care.
It is a profound tension. And it's clear we still disagree on exactly where to draw that definitive boundary of medical responsibility. But examining this intersection between our incredible clinical capacity, our institutional blind spots, and the structural conditions that enable human life is immensely valuable for the future of medicine. For anyone listening who wants to grapple with these concepts themselves, I highly recommend delving into Dr. Sahali's detailed conceptual manuscript.
I wholeheartedly agree. It is a text that will challenge your assumptions, regardless of which side of the boundary you naturally lean toward. There is so much more to explore in the material, especially regarding the prospective demonstration opportunities for medical faculties over the coming years.
Ultimately, it brings to mind the image of a master watchmaker.
Oh, I like this analogy.
Right? We expect that watchmaker to have absolute microscopic focus, to tune the smallest springs and gears to perfect precision. But if that perfectly calibrated watch is constantly being submerged in salt water, it will fail. And you can't fix it just by tightening the gears again. As a profession, we have to decide if our responsibility ends at the edge of the workbench or if we finally have a duty to ask who keeps flooding the room.